The International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation, based at King's College in London, estimates 12,000 foreign jihadists are fighting with groups including Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And Australians feature prominently as raids across New South Wales and Queensland suggest 15 people were detained in a major security crackdown. According to our first guest, the conditions that are attracting foreigners to Middle East battlegrounds today are worse than the conditions in the lead-up to the 9/11 attacks of 2001. Anthony Bubalo is a former Australian diplomat in Saudi Arabia. He's now research director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. I've been asking Anthony Bubalo to compare the two scenarios.
Things like repression in Middle Eastern countries that radicalizes young men, that pushes them into the hands of radical ideologues, who then get into conflict with these regimes, end up as refugees from their own countries, and they end up in Afghanistan, where they come together looking for some way to continue the struggle, and they decide to shift the struggle from the rulers of their own countries to the West. They were the conditions that led to 9/11, kind of crudely. When we look at the region today, a lot of those conditions are there, and they're worse.
Amplified.
So you've seen, after the kind of the hope of the Arab uprisings, you've seen a wave of repression in places like Egypt, which is again radicalizing young men typically. We've seen conflict zones emerge in the region that become areas where these young men, radicalized young men, go and get military skills. In the same way that they went in the 80s and 90s to Afghanistan to get military skills, today they're going to Syria and Iraq to get those skills.
Is the potential there for now an even greater grievance that we're redeploying troops? I mean, does this escalate that grievance that's been around for 25 years?
In the specific case of ISIS in Iraq, there is no question that every action produces a reaction, that our decision to take military action against ISIS in Iraq will produce a reaction and will focus the minds of those extremists in ISIS on the West now. And they're making threats now. There's a question about whether they have the capability to carry out those threats. There's no question of that. But the other part of that question is, well, what's the alternative? Do you sit back and you do nothing? And unfortunately, we know what happens from doing nothing. We did nothing for 3 years in Syria, which became a magnet for jihadist groups. And over that 3 years, you saw this development of this pool of combat-experienced and increasingly networked jihadists that will, we know from experience, will end up going somewhere else. You don't have to know that tomorrow they are going to start targeting Western countries. But we know from our experience in Afghanistan in the 80s and 90s, once these guys have won their local battle, they will move on to other conflicts, as they did in that era when they went from Afghanistan to Chechnya, Bosnia, and eventually into Al-Qaeda.
And one of the ways, of course, that the conflict is spread is through diasporas. Now, you wrote in a recent piece that successful law enforcement and prevention must involve local Muslim communities. But you've also said the dialogue with Muslim leaders won't always be easy. What do you mean by that?
Because Muslim communities themselves have multiple leaders. There are kind of deep divisions within those communities, particularly on this issue. There is great sensitivity, great defensiveness, as you'd expect. I mean, being a Muslim in Australia today, watching the events of the last couple of weeks, you cannot be but fearful for the future of your community, for the way that other people will look at you. So it's not going to be an easy process. And sometimes I think we place too much of a burden on those communities to deal with that without recognizing that we have a role to play here as well. There has to be, as a critical element of any counterterrorism policy, a positive effort to engage the Muslim community and also to engage them in a genuine discussion. It can't simply be, well, let's have one or two consultative meetings and we'll do what we want to do anyway.
Yeah. Well, one of the points that you made in that very perceptive piece in The Interpreter, you say that there is room for greater frankness with Muslim communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, have we been tiptoeing around problems in the diaspora that now needs greater frankness?
It's frankness on both sides. We should expect frankness from Muslim communities as well. We should also be kind of frank in return. But you can have a frank conversation if it's sustained. Mm. If it's simply coming in and wagging your finger at the Muslim community and saying, it's not going to work. And vice versa, we should expect, you know, their kind of frank views on the ways in which, you know, federal government policies and state government policies impact on their communities. So yes, there's a need for frankness, but frankness that's an honest, sustained dialogue over a period where both sides understand, well, we're actually going to get somewhere. You're not just wagging your finger at each other.
Yes, not just this constant series of crisis meetings, as it were.
Exactly.
One of the things that leapt out at me in your recent paper, looking at jihadists, was the sheer numbers. Mm. Have we got something like almost twice the number of people in the field in these jihadi battlegrounds today than existed in the 1980s?
So in the 1980s, you had at any one time probably around 4,000 foreign fighters fighting in Afghanistan. And typically these were men from around the Arab world, who went to fight with the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. Of that group, a small number ended up within the ranks of al-Qaeda. Today, you know, you're talking 10, 15,000 foreign fighters that have gone to Syria and Iraq. So a much larger number. And what's significant about that number too is that the proportion of people from Western countries is much higher than it was in the case of Afghanistan. And one of the reasons for that is that Iraq and Syria, as conflicts, have been much easier to get through. You can head to Turkey as a tourist and cross the border without difficulty. Getting to Afghanistan was much harder. The other worrying element of that is that because you've got so many of these guys traveling on Western passports that enable them to kind of cross borders much more easily than you would if you were traveling on a Saudi passport or a Pakistani passport. And in fact, there are many countries that you would have visa-free access. So one of the concerns is not just that this pool of potential extremists is larger, but that their ability to travel and to cross borders is much greater than that previous
area. Yeah, and
they
pick up two skills that you mentioned. One skill is how to make a bomb. Mm. And the other skill is how to network.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems self-explanatory, but tell me, why are they so dangerous, that combination of those two skills?
Because one of the things that we did over that kind of 9/11 era was, through the counterterrorism efforts, we were able to degrade the skills of these organizations. So because you arrested their most skillful bomb makers, because you killed their most skillful bomb makers, because you took away the areas where they could freely train or gain combat experience, which we did, you know, when we went into Afghanistan, because you take away that physical ability to kind of come into contact with extremists from other groups and forge some of those connections which are useful, we saw over that decade that the success rate of attacks declined. Mm. So people were still trying to mount terrorist attacks towards the end of that decade, but they weren't working. And you saw that particularly in places like Indonesia, where you still have extremists trying to launch terrorist attacks, but they're bumblers, they're incompetent, they don't know how to make bombs. It's typically pick up a gun or a knife and attack a police station. What we don't want are those bumblers to gain military skills and to be able to launch much more lethal attacks as a result of, you know, skills they pick up in Syria and Iraq.
Just as we wind up, Anthony, your paper warns us, don't forget Egypt as a potential source of jihadi violence.
Yeah. Egypt has always been important because it's one of the most, if not most important countries in the Middle East. But in terms of the Islamist movement, it's always been a leading country. You know, key figures in Islamism come from Egypt. So movements like the Muslim Brotherhood, people like Saad Qutb, who was a key ideologue for the Muslim Brotherhood, but also became, through some of his writings, a key ideologue for extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, contemporary groups. Like
Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was also Egyptian, who's the new leader and was bin Laden's longtime deputy. So what happens in Egypt doesn't just matter for Egypt, it matters for the broader region. And what we're seeing in Egypt now is a very tumultuous process after the uprising that overthrew the Mubarak regime. You saw democratic parliamentary and presidential elections that elected the head of the Muslim Brotherhood as president. The Brotherhood took a series of steps in an anti-democratic direction, and the result of that was that the military in Egypt mounted a coup. Since then, the leader of the military has thrown off his military uniform, donned the civilian garb, ran in an election basically unopposed, and has been elected president. He's elected a president and he's popular. But the problem has been, since the coup in the middle of last year, there has been this wave of repression that is now radicalizing particularly younger generation Muslim Brotherhood leaders. And because the Brotherhood is such an influential organization worldwide, it's very worrying for us that these younger generation guys are now basically saying, you know what, peaceful approach to politics that the Brotherhood has taken, you know, with some exceptions in the Middle East, that these guys are now saying we should abandon that and we should now kind of turn to violence. And if that really catches hold. That's deeply influential, not just in the Middle East, but also in places like Indonesia, where young Indonesian students go to Egypt to study at Al-Azhar, one of the most important Islamic educational institutions in the world, come into connection with these younger Muslim brothers who are radicalized by what's going on in Egypt. You know, they may pick up ideas about, is it worthwhile pursuing peaceful political participation through democracy, or should we do something more extreme, given that we've seen what's happened in Egypt, and we've seen that even if we play by the political rules of the game, they won't let us win.
Anthony Bubalo, Research Director at the Lowy Institute for International Relations. Anthony's paper is called Next Gen Jihad in the Middle East. I thank you very much for coming into the Religion and Ethics Report.
It's a pleasure.